From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. After almost a week of wrangling, it appears that Iraq's prime minister has decided to resign after all. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki Thursday announced his resignation in a speech on state television. He said he supports the nominated replacement for his post, Haider Abadi. The move comes after reports of furious behind-the-scenes U.S. diplomatic maneuvering to support Abadi. We have this report from Press TV.
Iraq's incumbent Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has agreed to give up his post and step aside. Maliki made that remark during a televised speech. He also pledged to endorse Haider al-Abadi as the country's next prime minister. Maliki's Da'wa party had earlier vowed to challenge Abadi's nomination in the federal court. Now Maliki's announcement is set to pave the way for the formation of a new government in Baghdad. Iraq has been grappling with political turmoil and rising insurgency in the northern parts of the country. Well, to discuss that a bit further, and I joined Mr. Sabah Jawad, who is the director of Iraqi Democrats Against Occupation, and he's joining us live now from London. Mr. Jawad, thanks for joining us. Now, how do you feel about this news now that it seems that this political crisis over the prime minister has ended?
Well, it was inevitable, actually, that this will happen. Seems that even his own party has abandoned. There's increasing number of his member of parliament from a Da'wa party abandoned him and sided with Mr. Abadi. And also the Marja'iya was against him, and his former allies in the so-called Shia alliance also, who were campaigning very vigorously against him, as well as the Sunni and the Kurdish fronts. And the Americans came heavily against him, basically had no choice. If he went to the federal court, the American would stitch him up there as well by putting a huge pressure on the court, actually, to come out with a verdict which is suitable for him as well. The only thing that's clear from this crisis is that the American are back in full control of political process in Iraq as a result of what's happening in Mosul. They use the opportunity of getting back to Iraq. Now they are bombarding some part of north of Iraq, and they might move to other part of the country and even establish military bases in northern Iraq and Kurdistan, especially since their ally, the Kurdish leadership, they were never happy about the American leaving Iraq in the first place in 2011. In fact, they offered them at that time military bases to stay in Iraq, and they were against the SOFA agreement, which led to the departure of the American troops from Iraq. So the political situation is gloomy. The American now in full control, and in fact, they undermined even the shaky political process they established in Iraq in 2003. They've been talking about getting rid of dictatorship in Iraq in 2003 and establishing democracy and democratic institutions, while in their latest move against al-Maliki, they undermined all these so-called democratic procedure and institutions, which would put them in a very bad light indeed. Therefore, the present in Iraq is detrimental to democratic achievement if we want to achieve a democratic right in Iraq. And again, Iraq is not a sovereign country because America now controls the political process once again.
Although it got off to a shaky start, it appears that the five-day extension of the most recent ceasefire in Gaza has taken hold, and for humanitarian aid workers, it's been, well, a relief. Derek Mbatha reports from the United Nations.
The extension of the ceasefire in Gaza has been welcomed by UN humanitarian agencies. Israelis and Palestinians on Thursday began to observe the five-day ceasefire, which has been described as the longest since the hostilities broke out in July. UN spokesperson Stefan Dujarric says the truce will enable humanitarian work to continue in Gaza.
Humanitarian agencies have welcomed the extension of the ceasefire in Gaza, which enable humanitarian workers to carry out life-saving activities, to complete search and rescue operations in several areas, and to repair critical water, sanitation networks, and electricity infrastructure. The removal of unexploded ordnance in built-up areas will continue, as will repair work in schools. Safe and secure transportation inside the Gaza Strip during the ceasefire will enhance the delivery of urgently needed supplies.
Spokesperson Dujarric said the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, has started to distribute maternity packages to mothers who have given birth during the current hostilities and who are registered as displaced people in its shelters across the Gaza Strip. A total of 344 babies, 152 girls, and 192 boys have been born in UNRWA schools designated as shelters, he added. Derek Mbata, United Nations.
Meanwhile, another announcement of another international effort to break the siege of Gaza, this one by a group of North African nations. Press TV's Adnan Chawachi reports from Tunis.
The Maghreb Forum for International Cooperation has launched a pro-Palestine project in Tunisia, Libya, Morocco, Algeria, and Mauritania to defy Israel by sending aid convoys to Gaza.
Sending relief and medical convoys from all over the world and the Arab Maghreb to Gaza Strip will embarrass Israel and show the truth on what's happening in Gaza.
The Association of Parliamentarians for Al-Quds gathers Tunisian and foreign MPs and lawmakers. They are preparing a war crimes case against Israel for the Gaza massacre.
A number of lawyers and MPs are going to sue Israel at European and other international courts to hold it responsible for its horrible crimes. Israel is committing atrocities. It is worse than Nazi genocide. It is the worst in modern history.
Activists argue that despite the treason committed by some Arab regimes against the Palestinian cause, the isolation of Tel Aviv is the goal of the civil society in the Arab Maghreb and the rest of the world.
Our initiative aims to support Palestine and to end all forms of normalization with Israel. The regional regimes that normalize ties with Tel Aviv must pay. We also call for boycotting Israeli products and any companies that finance Zionists.
Analysts say Israeli military will not stop killing civilians without international pressure on Tel Aviv. Human rights activists in the Arab Maghreb region have now joined a global movement to isolate Israel. Adnan Chawachi, Press TV, Tunis.
There was more wrangling over Russia's Ukraine-bound humanitarian aid. First, we have this report from Press TV.
A Russian aid convoy is trying to make its way to eastern Ukraine. The huge convoy earlier stopped in central Russia after Ukraine said it would not let it cross the border. The trucks stalled near Voronezh. Kiev claimed Moscow could use the convoy as a pretext for military action in Ukraine.
There are three things that could happen with this convoy from Russia. First, they would attack us but pretend it's aid. Second thing, there could be a provocation on the territories where the aid is sent, and there would be a chance of a provocation with Russia. Third, the aid would come to a Ukrainian city, and the border guards would check the aid, and if everything is okay, they would allow the aid in.
Russia has dismissed as absurd claims its aid convoy is a pretext to send military supplies to pro-Russian forces. Kiev, however, has now decided to send in its own aid convoy to the conflict zone in the east. Scores of lorries with 800 tons of aid left Kiev, Kharkiv, and Dnipropetrovsk for Lugansk. The move is seen as an attempt to beat out the convoy of some 300 trucks sent by Russia. Kiev and its Western allies claim the humanitarian convoy is an attempt by Moscow to establish a permanent Russian presence in the region. But citizens of the war-stricken East have long been calling on the Kremlin to send in relief. The residents of eastern Ukraine told us that the decision by Kiev is too little, too late.
I saw on TV the Ukrainian government plans to send aid, but they only did this after Russia did. The Ukrainian government is trying to show that they are good. They should have done it earlier. Now it's too late.
As the row over a controversial Russian aid convoy continues, heavy shelling has hit the city of Donetsk. The UN says some 2,086 people have been killed since the conflict in the east began in mid-April. More than half of them have been in the past 2 weeks. Serena Shim, Press TV, Kramatorsk, Eastern Ukraine.
But as of Friday, Russia's Ukraine-bound humanitarian aid was being processed at the Donetsk border crossing in Russia, the Operations Information Center said Friday. The government of Argentina is ready to use an anti-terrorism law to seek criminal charges against a U.S.-based international printing company, which unexpectedly closed its plant on the outskirts of Buenos Aires. The company's sudden filing for bankruptcy and shutdown left around 400 people jobless. Argentine President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner said in a speech Thursday, quote, "We are facing a real case of fraudulent behavior and an attempt to intimidate the population," closed quote. Kirchner accused the printing company of being linked to foreign hedge funds, or vulture funds as they're called, whose decade-long legal battle against the country in U.S. courts resulted in Argentina's July default. The president reportedly believes there were insufficient grounds for the company to shut down, a move which she assumes undermines the nation's economy. If proven true, that would be a potential violation of Argentina's anti-terrorism law enacted in 2011, which has not yet been applied. The print company, R.R. Donnelly, had reportedly not commented on the situation as of press time Friday. Tensions continued in Ferguson, Missouri, Thursday night over the killing by police of 18-year-old Michael Brown. We have this from Press TV.
Families of U.S. shooting victims say more needs to be done to protect minority youth. Their call comes amid rising tensions over the fatal shooting of an unarmed black teenager by a Missouri policeman last week. The mother of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin, a black teenager who was killed by a Florida neighborhood watchman, voiced her concerns on Thursday. She said young black teenagers in the U.S. feel threatened by authorities and that far more needs to be done to protect them. Her son's killer, George Zimmerman, was subsequently acquitted of murder charges after claiming self-defense. UN statistics show that African Americans make up 13% of the U.S. population. 50% of them fall victim to homicide. Well, to discuss that further, we're now joined by Brandon Nassar, who is a writer and political activist who's joining us now on the line from Maryland. Mr. Nassar, thanks very much for joining us here on Press TV. And I wanted to get your take on this issue of what this incident took place in Ferguson, Missouri, as well as this overall issue of institutionalized racism.
Thank you so much for having me. And I do want to echo what you just said, that this is an overall problem that stems from really a legacy of African Americans in this country stemming from slavery and Jim Crow practices that have brutalized African Americans, particularly African American males, for generations now. And what we're seeing in Ferguson is really an uprising that has been rooted in continuous practices of racial profiling, of targeting African-American males and stopping and frisking them, violating their rights. And this is something that simply we're not going to stand for anymore. And we're seeing that backlash taking place right now in Ferguson.
You know, the question on many people's minds, Ms. Nassar, is why? Why are we still seeing this in the United States, especially after what we had been told was a successful civil rights movement?
Well, again, I think going back, you have to look at the history of the United States. And simply put, African Americans were brought over as chattel. We've always been viewed as property. And this is really a control tactic to keep certain populations in line. We see that the prison industrial complex, is a for-profit institution, and it needs bodies, and it's the most convenient place to get them from young, black, disenfranchised youths on the street. And we're seeing that over and over again. You can call it Jim Crow, even now the mass incarceration epidemic. These are all a continuation of the Jim Crow and slavery practices that we've seen in this country.
So then, what do you propose? What are the solutions then going forward? Many people have brought up, you know, various different theories, but how do you see a solution at this point?
Well, I think right now what we're seeing is the first step, which is, first of all, to redress what we have experienced in this country in a unified way, and to say that it is our right to be able to walk the streets freely without being harassed, without being executed, and that we need to propose to really bring to the forefront all of the problems that we experience as a community. It's not just in the prison industrial complex, from health care disparities, employment, and housing. All of these things need to be put on the main stage and addressed, really for really overdue practices that have taken place.
And we just have under a minute left, Ms. Nestor. So I wanted to speak about how important do you think unity is between many of the minorities that are now, if I may use the word, oppressed in the United States, such as, you know, Native Americans, obviously, themselves, who have been oppressed for a very long time, African Americans, and also now Muslim Americans.
Well, I think unity right now is more important than ever, and we see that practices that have affected African Americans are now trickling down. We see this from Islamophobia and other practices that are discriminating against people of color in the United States. I think we're starting to see that connection between other oppressed minorities in the community, and it's ever more critical right now for us to unite, especially with what's going on in Ferguson.
There were reports Friday morning that tensions were abating some after the replacement of local police. On Thursday, from Martha's Vineyard, President Obama spoke about the situation in Ferguson.
I want to address something that's been in the news over the last couple of days, and that's the situation in Ferguson, Missouri. I know that many Americans have been deeply disturbed by the images we've seen in the heartland of our country as police have clashed with people protesting. Today, I'd like us all to take a step back and think about how we're going to be moving forward. Now, this morning, I received a thorough update on the situation from Attorney General Eric Holder, who's been following it and been in communication with his team. I've already tasked the Department of Justice and the FBI to independently investigate the death of Michael Brown, along with local officials on the ground. The Department of Justice is also consulting with local authorities about ways that they can maintain public safety without restricting the right of peaceful protest and while avoiding unnecessary escalation. I made clear to the Attorney General that we should do what is necessary to help determine exactly what happened and to see that justice is done. I also just spoke with Governor Jay Nixon of Missouri. I expressed my concern over the violent turn that events have taken on the ground and underscored that now's the time for all of us to reflect on what's happened and to find a way to come together going forward. He is going to be traveling to Ferguson. He is a good man and a fine governor, and I'm confident that working together, he's going to be able to communicate his desire to make sure that justice is done and his desire to make sure that public safety is maintained in an appropriate way. Of course, it's important to remember how this started. We lost a young man, Michael Brown, in heartbreaking and tragic circumstances. He was 18 years old. His family will never hold Michael in their arms again. And when something like this happens, the local authorities, including the police, have a responsibility to be open and transparent about how they are investigating that death and how they are protecting the people in their communities. There is never an excuse for violence against police or for those who would use this tragedy as a cover for vandalism or looting. There's also no excuse for police to use excessive force against peaceful protests or to throw protesters in jail for lawfully exercising their First Amendment rights. And here in the United States of America, police should not be bullying or arresting journalists who are just trying to do their jobs and report to the American people on what they see on the ground. Put simply, we all need to hold ourselves to a high standard, particularly those of us in positions of authority. I know that emotions are raw right now in Ferguson, and there are certainly passionate differences about what has happened. There are going to be different accounts of how this tragedy occurred. There are going to be differences in terms of what needs to happen going forward. That's part of our democracy. But let's remember that we're all part of one American family. We are united in common values, and that includes belief in equality under the law, a basic respect for public order, and the right to peaceful public protest, a reverence for the dignity of every single man, woman, and child among us, and the need for accountability when it comes to our government. So now's the time for healing. Now's the time for peace and calm on the streets of Ferguson. Now is the time for an open and transparent process to see that justice is done. And I've asked that the Attorney General and the U.S. Attorney on the scene continue to work with local officials to move that process forward. They will be reporting to me in the coming days about what's being done to make sure that happens.
Over the past few days, protests in Ferguson appeared to resemble a war zone when militarized police began firing tear gas and non-lethal ammunition into the streets towards private residences. Two journalists, one from the Washington Post and another from Huffington Post, were briefly detained while on assignment. RT's Kevin Owen spoke with political cartoonist Ted Rawl about the militarization of police in the U.S. and the relationship between police and the communities they are supposed to serve.
Hi there, Ted. Barack Obama's called for a thorough investigation into the killing of this guy, Mr. Brown. What do you think about it? Is that really going to be enough end of the day? Is that really going to calm things down, or is it too little too late?
Well, obviously it's too late. We're looking at a fourth possible night of civil unrest on the streets of this small town outside St. Louis. And it's not the first time this has happened. This is a situation that repeats itself in all sorts of African-American communities across the United States that are policed as though they were occupied territory by highly militarized, I would say U.S. troops, but local police who are equipped as though they were occupying Afghanistan or Iraq. So, there's no connection whatsoever, but just hostility between the communities that are being policed and the police that are supposed to be serving them. That's the big issue. That's the big problem. And I don't see how the president, in his investigation over this one incident, would be able to make much headway there. This is going to be an ongoing problem.
Would it help if this was a very public trial, or that the officer was publicly brought to book over this, trialed fairly over it? Do you think that make a difference? And why are the police apparently being so heavy-handed right now? I mean, Barack Obama again has criticized that as well. Again, too little, too late, you tell me.
Well, transparency is obviously would be very welcome here. The police still refuse to release the name of the officer who was involved in the shooting. If it were you or me who was accused of shooting someone, of course our names would be released by the police immediately. They're protecting themselves, and there's not much of a history in the United States of police being found guilty of these kinds of shootings, white cops shooting black kids. And when there are sentences, which are very rare, they tend to be very short slaps on the wrist. I was talking with my journalistic colleagues recently. Nobody could recall an example of a police officer facing any kind of serious prison time for this kind of incident in our memories.
Well, we're saying even the journalists have been roughed up here reporting on this story. It doesn't bode well, does it? Why are they being so heavy-handed? And, of course, at the backdrop of this as well, many police forces across the United States are getting heavy-duty weaponry from the overseas war zones. I mean, it's a real bad mixing pot, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, the history of this really goes back to the 1970s and when Los Angeles created a militarized SWAT team, as it was called, and other police departments have adopted SWAT tactics. But things have really accelerated since 9/11 and the wind down of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and all this equipment. In terms of the heavy-handedness, I think that when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And that's what's going on here. The more equipment you give the cops, the more they're going to be inclined to use it. There's also economic incentives for them to use them. They're told that they're going to lose this equipment if they don't use it from time to time. So in the city of St. Louis, in fact, or in St. Louis County, You can't even deliver a warrant to someone without SWAT team accompaniment. So even if you're delivering a warrant for a minor nonviolent offense, the SWAT team shows up at your front door armed to the teeth. It's a combustible situation.
Do people in America generally have respect for the police? Do they garner respect for this? Are they liked? Are they not liked? What's the position? And, you know, we're also getting the police telling people to be calm tonight there. But judging by the way the police are handling the people, it's going to count against them, surely, isn't it? It's going to go the other way.
Well, in America, it's deeply divided by race and by politics. So if you're African American, if you lean to the left, the odds are you don't have much respect for the police, or you view them mostly with fear. That's certainly the way I look at them. But there are certainly people who respect the police, particularly on the right, and particularly white middle class people who don't feel that if you don't do anything wrong, you have nothing to fear.
Meanwhile, protests against the police killings have taken place in more than 100 U.S. cities already, and this shows no sign of letting up. Press TV's Marzi Hashimi has more.
Thousands of protesters have held rallies in more than 100 cities across the United States to honor the memory of a black teenager shot dead by police in Missouri. Huge rallies have been organized in New York, Boston, St. Louis, and Philadelphia. Protesters criticized police for killing unarmed Michael Brown and urged to end racial killings there. Meanwhile, security in the city of Ferguson, Missouri, where the deadly incident took place, has been handed over to state police. Now, that decision has been taken after nights of violent clashes there. Local police have been criticized for dealing harshly with protesters. Let's cross over to Washington, joined by Press TV's correspondent Colin Camel. Colin, good to have you with us. Please fill us in on the situation. More than 100 cities now that these demonstrations have taken place. Can you give us the latest on that situation?
Yeah, these protesters uniting around the nation have called it a day of rage. This is to call attention to the shooting of the unarmed man, Michael Brown, the 18-year-old, who was allegedly caught up in a scuffle with police and was shot dead by the end. And what this day of rage brings to light is the feeling that many minorities in this country, particularly African Americans, feel as if they are targeted by the police. At the very least, they don't feel that police are protecting the interests of them as a people. And so we've heard of these stories like the Trayvon Martin stories and the Sean Bell stories, and there's so many of these stories where authorities have ended up shooting and killing usually a young black man, and they're usually acquitted. There's usually a trial that goes on, but no one has ever felt culpable. And so that's why you see these protesters so angry across the nation in many big cities, where you have a police mentality to almost shoot first, ask questions later, or at least assume that someone is guilty before you actually know the situation. And you're seeing a lot of frustration among civilians and the population. And of course, we've seen this frustration boil over into outrage and anger, where we saw looting in Ferguson. And that's why the police department has been, there's been a switch up in the police department and the policing of that area. The governor has called for state police to start policing the area, because local police have been found to even treat people unfairly after the Michael Brown incident. Journalists were arrested, they were detained, and then released without being charged. So this situation is still very much out of hand, and we are going to see more protesting. I'm not sure for how long, but there is still really no answer to what happened on that fateful night back on Saturday. The police, the policeman who was allegedly involved in this incident has not been named yet. All we know is that there is yet another dead black man by the hands of police.
Well, Colin, what appears to be different this time around? As you said, it's not the first time. This has been going on for forever, basically. But this time around, we see what appears to be an organized effort or nationwide efforts to for people to voice their opposition to what they are seeing as a growing problem. What appears to be different this time around, that we're seeing it taken to a national level and to many, many cities?
If you were to compare it to, say, the Trayvon Martin incident, where we also saw a large outpouring of support for the Martin family, this is just an evolution of what we saw with Trayvon Martin, because we saw even then there were protests happening around the nation. We saw big protests in Washington, D.C., also done through social media, through flyers on television, through broadcast media. But now we're just seeing it even more so. And I suspect that this isn't going to be the last unfortunate incident of this caliber that we're hearing about. And we're going to see even bigger numbers next time, with more people getting involved because of social media, because of the outrage, and the simple fact that it hasn't stopped happening.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.